So we're up to the point in the Genjo Koan where to study the Buddha way is to study the self. Now, you probably know the Genjo Koan.
Yeah.
If you'd like a copy, if there's one around.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Excuse me, could you just comment again on the phrase just before to study the Buddha way, one side is illuminated, the other side is darkened?
Unlike things in the reflections in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. And that's following after when you see forms or hear sounds fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. So various ways we could see this is like when one, I think last week I talked about when we're looking at things through the perspective of like the ultimate truth, then the relative truth is obscured, or where there's just the ultimate. From the point of view of like emptiness, there is nothing happening. We actually say there's really nothing happening from that perspective. And then from the perspective of like there is all this happening, when we're meeting things in this in the relative world of things happening, it makes no sense to say there's nothing happening. So when we're like on one side, there's only that one side. Even though, philosophically speaking, we could say both sides are always together, the relative and the ultimate, when we're fully meeting kind of experientially as a practice, meeting one side, the ultimate or the relative, the other side is dark, or the other side is doesn't show. And similar to this is in the merging of difference and unity, where it says, right in light there is darkness, but don't confront it as darkness. Right in darkness there is light, but don't see it as light. So similarly, light and dark there are talking about relative and ultimate. That light is the relative world where we can see the myriad things, and dark is like the realm where nothing is distinguished as separate. In darkness, there's just one field of darkness. So in the realm where we're in that field of darkness, like really deep zazen, where conceptual thinking has settled down and is not creating a world of objects, maybe for a short time in zazen, you might have such an experience. At that time, there's no world. There's no, right there in darkness, there is light, but don't see it as light. Like, don't, comment on that world of darkness. And likewise, when there's, in the midst of our, like, thinking conceptual mind, right in that world of light and distinguished objects, there is darkness, but don't confront it as darkness. In other words, don't try to like say, but it's all empty, it's all not really happening. It's just another conceptual thought. And another way to relate it, particularly to the point about grasping things directly, is a direct experience, like a direct sensory experience. We talked about these stories of the seeing peach blossoms. This one of the Zen ancestors awakened just seeing peach blossoms. There was just the seeing, and just hearing the pebble hit the bamboo. There was just the sound. There was no extra commentary on it. So that's like seeing forms, hearing sounds, fully engaging body and mind. You can grasp things directly, like a direct experience, direct sensory experience. And at that time, there's no relative, there's no commenting like, oh, a pebble just hit a bamboo and made a sound. How wonderful. So at the moment of direct experience, there's no indirect experience, and at the moment of indirect experience, which is like conceptually mediated experience, we could say in a way there is direct experience at the same time too, but we don't, we're not in touch with that. So on one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. When there's the world of direct experience, the other side, which really is there at the same time, the other side, it's just dark. We're not in that realm. And I think a lot of the flavor of the Genjo Koan, the part we'll get into today that continues, has the same sense of completely one thing at a time. This whole thing about firewood and ash that we're going to get into is like when there's one event happening, there's just that event happening and there's nothing else before or after. So this little premonition to this next section, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. You're welcome. Then this next paragraph is, you know, some people say that the first paragraph is the summary of the whole thing, and that makes sense, but also this particular paragraph about studying the Buddha way is to study the self is such a central summarizing paragraph of the whole essay, and one of the most often quoted paragraphs of Dogen Zenji. It's like the whole practice in one paragraph, and put very beautifully. And you could say this doesn't really build on itself. It's not like steps, like there's these five sentences, but they're not necessarily chronological steps. I mean, first, there's to study the way, is to study the self. Then, there's to study the self, is to forget the self. It's like they're all saying the same thing, but in different ways. So, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. And more than one of the commentaries say something like, no explanation is needed here. Like, this is, you know, abundantly clear. This is just how it is. He says it all, right? Just like that. But I think it's so important and so such a helpful practice instruction that I think it's nice to go through this and just take it apart a little bit, or to just clarify each of these sentences to really embed each one in our mind. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self, is a whole, you know, practice instruction in itself. We think, well, to study Buddhism, like the Buddha way, to study Buddhism or to study Zen means like reading all the sutras and the records of the ancestors and study. And this word study means study or learn, is another translation. To learn the Buddha way is to learn the self. So although it does and can involve all those kinds of study of external words and also external practices, like to study the Buddha way means to study the forms of Zazen and how to do ceremonies and how to all the myriad aspects of Zen practice. You could say that's studying Buddha Dharma. That's what studying Buddhism involves. If somebody were to ask us, what is the study of Buddhism? How do you study Buddhism? How do you learn Buddhism? We might come up with a list of all those things, right? But in the end, at the core of all of those is to study the Buddha way, is really to study the self, to study this body and mind, this being. Again, could be like to study the illusion of a separate independent self, or it could be to study the dependently arisen body, mind, experience of five skandhas that we call, provisionally call self. Both study all of that and how the two get confused. Or to study the big self, it's the entire universe with no limitation or boundaries at all. Big self. Study big self, study small self, study is there any difference between them. Study the difference, study the non-difference. But particularly our experience. That's another way to say it. To study the Buddha way is to study our intimate personal experience of this very moment. Also not in a general way, because a lot of the sutras and the records of the ancestors do talk about the self, actually. And they're very helpful, so studying in that general way, but in the specific way of this moment, maybe instead of general, I should say like the kind of more abstract way. The ideas about the self, but actually to study this experience right now of this person. And then we might ask, well, how do we do that? To study the self is to forget the self. Shifts it back to actually studying and learning, we might feel like, is concentrating, focusing on very carefully the intricacies of how this body-mind experience is happening. And that would be part of it too. That wouldn't be, we shouldn't deny that side. But this is like, the other side is to study the self, is actually to forget the self completely. Let go of any ideas of the self. Forget is kind of a funny word, but I think almost all translations use the word forget. Yep. Gets to the basic, the Japanese word really does mean to forget. To learn of the self, to study the self, is to forget the self, which has a sense of letting go. Not ignoring, not pushing away, not destroying, not absent-mindedly being not mindful of what's happening in our experience. Not like that kind of forgetting, but more the forgetting of letting go of the self. So to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things, is the next sentence, which was stated earlier, pretty much like that, in the sentence of myriad things come forth and experience themselves, or literally, that myriad things come forth and practice and actualize, the self is awakening. So, same thing. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. So to forget all our ideas about this person and who this is, and all our running commentary about who we think we are. It's pretty much continuous. To study the self is to just temporarily to just forget that self for this moment. Let go of all the ideas about ourself. And at that moment that we let go of all the ideas about who we are and how we fit into the world and what we should be doing compared to what we are doing, all of that stuff, kind of the self-critique mind, to let go of that at that very moment, not kind of like later either, but at that very moment, is the myriad things, the whole, what we call the world, comes forth and actualizes the who actualizes the self, verifies the self. So here it doesn't have the word practice like it had earlier, but it's the same word for verify, confirm, actualize. To forget the self is to be actualized, verified, confirmed by the myriad things.
Even if we don't let go of our notions, aren't we also actualized by the myriad things?
Yeah, we actually are. Yeah, and we actually are letting go of our self all the time too. And we could, you know, to keep taking it back each sentence, we could say, and we actually are forgetting ourselves on the deepest level, and we actually are studying the self, so then we are studying Buddha Dharma. So on the deepest level, actually, we can't avoid this whole process. But are we in touch with that? And I think that type of question is really interesting and dynamic as it applies to this whole study of the Gendo Koan, which keeps coming from this ultimate perspective. And yet, it's like, how do we manifest it? How do we completely take it up and have it deeply pervade our lives so that we actually are... can come forth with this freedom to both be at ease ourselves and to help all beings. And some of the commentaries keep bringing this up in various ways. this is about the no trace part at the end, which, you know, we could have the same conversation in a way about, but just to respond to now, Yasutani Roshi says regarding like not having a trace of enlightenment, and he says if you're enlightened, it's no good, like keeping a trace of enlightenment, it's no good, but if you're not enlightened, it's even worse. And then if you don't break out in a cold sweat over this point, nothing will be accomplished. So that came to mind when, because in a way, it's true that actually we are being actualized by the myriad things all the time, and yet, what does it mean to forget the self and to actually, realize deeply that we're nothing but the actualization of the myriad things? So it's tricky, because then we say, oh, okay, you know, maybe for a moment we realize it, and we say, I got it, but then that creates this trace, and that's like a problem. But then to actually not fully get it is also a problem. And then to not break out in a cold sweat over the how to resolve this kind of seeming conflict between these two is also a problem.
So would the actualized being,
what's that?
Would the actualized being go about in the world meeting all the myriad things without being thinking about it, reflecting on it, and simply going along that path?
Yeah, I think to not add anything extra, and yet we do add extra, so then can we see that are adding extra, not add anything extra to the adding extra, you know, for example, like judging ourselves for thinking too much would be an example, you know, like, oh, I like got into the, or it was a simple situation here, how to relate to this person, and I started thinking about it too much, and I got all involved, and so then I said the wrong things, and if I just responded immediately to the person with my first immediate impulse, it would have worked out just great. But I got too worried and conceptualizing what I should do about it, and it messed it all up. And so like, how can I do that? I always do that. Now we're like adding more on top of it instead of like, that's just how it happened. Next. Next person. Okay. Here we go. Meet. And, oh, I did it again. Okay. Next. Yeah.
You said that we are always forgetting ourselves, the self. I didn't understand.
Well, just making this point that actually all of this is happening all the time. And the way you could say that we're forgetting ourselves is in the sense that forgetting the self is letting go of the self, letting go of this version of body-mind experience. In that sense, this body-mind experience is being let go of. It is dropping off every moment, whether we consciously let it drop off or not. Can you follow that? Like this moment that includes all of what we think we are is gone right now. And now there's another one that might look very similar, but it's actually a fresh moment of who we think we are. And that one just dropped away too, because everything's completely impermanent. Everything's dropping away all the time. So even to say, you know, drop off body and mind, it's not like, well, there's this held body and mind all through our life until this one moment when suddenly we drop it. I mean, experientially it might feel like that, but actually the deeper reality would be that the body and mind is dropping off, or the body and mind is releasing itself over and over again every single moment, and then we're receiving a new fresh one, and then that one's dropping off. So in that way, we're forgetting, or maybe it's more accurate to say the self is being forgotten or let go of every moment. And then the practice, though, then how do we practice with this? The practice is to forget the self. The self is being forgotten. And because it's being forgotten, we can practice forgetting the self. And because it's being forgotten, we must forget the self to be free. Because actually, the self, though it is being forgotten and it is falling away every moment, we perceive it as being held, and therefore we suffer. We feel like we're holding ourselves together and not letting ourselves go. When you could say that's delusion, that we think that is the case. So, to just see that actually body and mind are dropping off, and align our practice with that reality is just sitting.
Reminds me very much of the delusion and enlightenment and delusion
discussion. Yeah. Again, the same themes keep weaving through this whole Genja koan. So you could say, in this case, the delusion that the self is not dropping off, the great realization of that delusion is Buddha, you know, or is enlightenment. The great realization that actually we seem to be, that we actually are holding on to this thing that can't be held on to actually realize that delusion is enlightenment. Right? Whereas to be deluded about have the delusion that realization is our idea of realization, which might even be these words, like, now I get it, realization is just like getting in touch with, aligning our life with the fact that body and mind are dropping off all the time. That's realization. Got it. And so we could say, that's delusion, great delusion about realization. It's called it being a sentient being. Well, we can't help that. I mean, we're using words, so that's because this is a class. But actually, it's all delusion, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
manifest this or bring it forward, be present.
Be present. Mm-hmm. Be present. And you could say, again, if you want, if you can link that up to what's already happening by saying that we're always are present. You say, then because we are actually, right? But then how do? But then there's again this, you know, it's hard to find the right words to say it. Like aligning our, you know, supposed experience with what's actually happening. So you could say the practice of being present is actually, you know, intentionally letting go of past and future thinking, and so we're actually we're aligning our experience with the reality that we actually are always present, because there is no past and future. There never was or will be, because there's only the present always. But aligning ourselves in zazen or whenever with this moment, then it confirms or verifies that reality. So that's this, again, Dogen's, which is appearing here in the Genjo Koan, is his frequently used favorite expression, one of favorite expressions of shu sho, and practice and verification, a dash between them. Practice and verification are not two. Practice realization are not two. In this form is the practice of intentionally sitting upright and letting go of past and future thinking. That practice lines us up with the reality that there is just the present, and verifies it. So that's an example of the practice and the verification of the present. The practice of being present and the verification of presence are not two at the moment of practice. You follow?
The word verification, It's like actualize. I actually feel like some relationship with that. But verification, it's used synonymously with actualization?
Yeah. And confirmation, too. You know, literally, this character show.
That's translated as verification.
Sometimes very loosely translated as enlightenment. I think in the practice enlightenment of the Buddha way in here, right? But that's a very loose translation. You know, most accurately, this term show in Japanese means like verification or confirmation, and then which is like. It's used in in Rinzai Zen. There's this term Inka Shome, right? It's like that's a teacher's seal of verification of enlightenment. And so that's the same show. It's like a seal of verification or confirmation of awakening. And I think Dogen, you know, that was a well-known term, Inka Shome, or In Sho for short, which sometimes I think Dogen maybe used In Sho, or at least later Soto Zen ancestors, like a seal of confirmation or a seal of verification. And I think he's playing with that, you know, instead of having some teacher like approve you, it's like you're actually being approved or verified by the myriad things. And throughout the Genjo Koan too, like the, you know, when he's saying things like, the, you know, true transmission of Dharma is already complete, things like this. So he's playing with these ideas of like, we're trying to get some approval from maybe some particular person, something like that. But actually the myriad things are verifying all of us all the time. So to say, verify or confirm, I think actualize and realize are actually quite similar to verify. It's like, it's stretching the meaning of verify from a person confirming another person to like, um, making something so, or, you know, acknowledging something as so. How about that? Verifying something is kind of acknowledging that it's so, and actualizing or realizing is acknowledging that it's so. I think the word realize in English is a really wonderful word when we talk about realization, because it has this almost double meaning in English of the, you know, realizing, like it means understanding. Oh, I just realized that such and such happened, meaning like I just understood, but it also has the meaning, it has the real in it. So to realize is to like to actualize or to make real, make something real, or actualize means to make something actual. So realization of awakening has this, in English, has this kind of double meaning. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Of to like understand awakening, and it also means to like make it real, to you know, actualize or manifest what already is. Also, actualize or realize has that sense of something's already the case, but it's just being manifested or actualized or realized. And verify, it's a little bit different, but it's somewhat similar to something's already so, and we're verifying it that it's already so.
Indeed, this is so.
Indeed, this is so.
This
is it. But in our experience, yes, like confirming what's so. And I think the thing about practice and verification or not too is one moment of practice is a moment, and practice, I think I said one time, like practice is anything that we do while letting go of self-concern.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not some particular, practice means like sitting in a particular posture or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really make so much sense. Although it's, practice is always in a particular posture, right? But not this particular posture over this one. But it's very particular, and I think that's part of the play too on when I say just take this posture itself is a manifestation of awakening. Like this posture means like not like this one is better than some other one, but just whatever one you're in, this particular posture, because it's always this. Right? So there's a little play going on there too, which we can take, we can obscure and say it means like full lotus sitting with the left foot on the right thigh or something, because that's how Dogen said it. But like for example, in our the translation where Dogen talks, says this. He literally says, you know, to sit, the full lotus posture is full manifestation of Buddhahood. And I think it's Norman Fisher translates it as the meditation posture is the full realization of Buddhahood. Because to make sure that we don't get confused, that it means it has to be this full lotus posture in a particular thing. It's just the Dogen, that's the traditional thing. So Dogen says, it's like this. And people say, oh, I have to like squeeze my legs that way because that's only that is the full realization of Buddhahood. And I think we're trying to say, that's not what Dogen means. But he is saying it is the particular posture of the moment. Because that's the manifestation of the moment. The manifestation, it's like the posture of the whole universe. The myriad things are in this particular posture right now. A lot of the universe is very crooked. A very crooked posture, but it's completely manifesting the whole works. So is that a little bit about verify?
I mean, and it's not like an answer, but I'm not looking for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wanting to understand, deepen my understanding.
Yeah,
and
verify.
It's probably going to be something I'll be practicing with for a long time.
Yeah, I think it's nice to play with these words, verify, confirm, actualize, and manifest.
And realize. Yeah, I like throwing that in.
As kind of five different translations for the same thing that have different nuances.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think last week or the week before you also said they signify create.
Create, uh-huh. Yeah, somebody asked, I think, well, how is it that the myriad things, what do you mean, maybe you asked, how do the myriad things confirm the self? I remember that question came up, and my way of fumbling through an explanation at that point was something like they create the self. The myriad things create what we call the self. Maybe more accurately we could say the myriad things just, you know, arrayed as they are, is this experience of what that we call the self. It's not, you know, words are always, you know, distorting the picture in one way or another, because to say the myriad things create the self is like, poof, suddenly there's something here that gets created, but it's not that there's something here. It's just the myriad things as they are, you could say, is the self. But that, and but another way to say it is the myriad things as they are, or, you know, coming forth, is a more dynamic way of saying as they are, confirms the self. But not like not confirms a separate self apart from the myriad things. It's more that actually, and some of the commentaries try to make this strong point, that the myriad things and the self are not two different things. That the myriad things, it says here, we forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. And like, that's the new self or something. That's the fresh new self of the that's suddenly created by the myriad things. It's not quite right. It's more like the myriad things just arising each moment is what we call the self. We also dependent co-arising, right? Is this the term, the dependent co-arising of everything right now, is what we call the self. And we could say, but myself's here and all the things are out there. But actually, from the point of view of Buddha Dharma, it's not that they're out there or that I'm over here. It's just the dependent co-arising of the universe with no distinction between me and the universe. But we have this setup, this amazingly evolved setup of like these, you know, this these like sense organs all gathered. I think I mentioned this yesterday, right? Last week, of like if we could like take a, like an eyeball out and a nerve and like look around with it over here, we'd start to like, it would start to seem different. But it seems like we're experiencing from this little place here, over here, and it seems like then there's the world around us. But that's just the setup of how like the sense organs are like evolved in sentient beings. It's not even, I was going to say, it's like the mind is over here, but actually the mind is not over here. The brain, as a physical brain, is over here, but the mind has no location. Mind is not even inside the body. But this, because the sense organs, seem to, which are our experiencers of the world, seem to be all gathered around the same place, it fixes this location that we, you know, our like movie screen is like keeps moving around. Goes with us wherever we go. It goes with this body, basically. Yeah.
What's mind?
What's mind? The cypress tree in the garden. What's mind? Yeah. We can't say. We can't say. Yeah, well, mind is used throughout here, body and mind. And in this case, well, let's go to the next sentence, which talks about mind. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. Again, this very beautiful language that Dobin's using, I think, because he's really bringing in all these different points into each sentence. So, for example, he's got this point, this phrase, Shinjin Datsuraku, body and mind dropped off, or body and mind dropping off, which was Dogen's awakening moment as the story goes, is that you probably know this, right? That he, and when he was practicing in China, his teacher said, "How can you, you know?" The monk next to him falling asleep, right? And the teacher going around, hitting all the sleeping monks with his slipper or something like that, and said, "How can you, you know, if you're sleeping, how can you drop off body and mind?" Usually we don't talk about the sleeping part, but it's nice if you have sleepy zazen a lot. It's nice to remember that that you can't drop off body and mind while sleeping. I mean, in an experiential way. Which is interesting too, because it seems like that's like when you go to sleep, it's like just dropping off body and mind. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that the phrase came up around that, instead of like, when you're distracted, you can't drop off body and mind. You know, if you're grasping something really tightly, how can you drop off body and mind? It's interesting to me that it happens to be when you're sleepy, how can you drop off body and mind? But anyway, then Dogen uses this phrase throughout his writings, dropping off body and mind, dropping off. So here he kind of breaks it up and says, body and mind of self and body and mind of others drop away. So he brings in the self and other issue to even make it more clear. What we're talking about, body and mind here, is the... our body and minds is the one that we think is me. And there's, you know, different versions of this. This body and mind. You can read a very interesting commentary in the Transmission of Light, the Denko Roku, on when you, the ancestor Dogen, near the end of the book, when you get to his story, it's a commentary, you know, it's the awakening story, so it's his awakening story, dropping off body and mind, and there's a long commentary on what that means, according to Kazan, and he gets into some very subtle points about the body and mind that's dropped off, all different types of body and mind that are dropped off. But I think for the basic point today, to just keep it simple, to say that it's the limited body and mind that we are actually holding on to. We might feel like, I'm not holding on to a body and mind, but in some ways it's, you know, the way, one who we think we are, the body who we think we are, and the mind who we think we are, you know, short for the five skandhas. Five skandhas is body, and the first skandha is like body, and the other four are mind skandhas, mental aggregates of experience. So these are what we hold on to constitute a version of me, and then carry that self forward and verify the many things, which is delusion. So in this case, to be actualized by myriad things is the body and mind of this person dropping off, the limited view of separate me dropping off in the advent of the myriad things, and the bodies and minds of others, which seems to be implying that at this moment when this body and mind drops off, that actually the others' bodies and minds drop off too. And that was what the Buddha said at his awakening, was, now I see that actually everybody is dropping off all the time. Everybody is like Buddha. And whether they recognize that or not, it's the case. And it's also dropping off the distinction between self and other. So it's a really dynamic sentence there. Your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. And then finally, no trace of realization remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. So... if it, you know, everything drops away, and then you could say that's the realization. And if we say that's the realization, and say got it now, that's what we mean by trace. A trace is like it leaves like a track. It leaves like footprints, and Dogen's very into this point of that realization should have no trace. And traces can take the form of like arrogance, for example, or like, and they might even be internal traces, like, now I finally get it, and like, none of these other deluded people get it. Like, that's like a big trace. But no trace remains, and the no trace continues endlessly. But some other alternate translations are, I think that's a nice way of putting it, that what continues endlessly is the no trace. It's not that the realization continues, but the tracelessness. Well, you could say, in parentheses, the inner meaning of no trace is actually realization. Realization is no trace of anything. Another trace could be like attachment, too. So this you know, non-attachment, could, not even to enlightenment, is what continues endlessly. But some other translations are, there remains no trace of enlightenment, and one lets this traceless enlightenment come forth forever and ever. There is the ceasing the traces of enlightenment, which causes one to forever leave the traces of enlightenment, which is cessation. That one's a little convoluted, I think. And all traces of enlightenment then disappear, and this traceless enlightenment is continued on and on. Or there is a trace of realization that cannot be grasped when we endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. Mm-hmm. That's Shohaku Okamura's. Mm-hmm. I actually really like that one.
Read that one again.
There is a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. So instead of saying no trace of realization remains, he says there is a trace of realization, but it can't be grasped. And we endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. And endlessly express, and they all seem to be implying that there's something that goes on and on. It's not just a one moment thing of like, okay, enlightenment, now I can go back to my deluded life. It goes on and on. It's like now, and it makes sense, right, that if it's understanding that the myriad things are coming forth and actualizing the self, that's it's understanding a very dynamic process that's continuously manifesting itself, and so that the realization of the ever-changing, ever-evolving universe of dependent arising continues endlessly. Which is another point that Dogen makes over and over, that it's not this enlightenment issue. It's not this static one-time thing. It's like going beyond Buddha, continuously going beyond. And this expresses that in a really beautiful way with this sentence, that there's no trace, and then tracelessness continues. Or you could say there's another moment of realizing the ungraspability of the trace, and then we get a hold of that trace for a second. Oh, now I got that one. Okay, let that one go. Let go of that trace, and then we get another trace. Let go of that trace. Get another trace. Continuously letting go. Or that the whole thing is just continuously happening with no traces at all at some point. There's not even the issue of like getting another trace or not. There's just living this life for the benefit of all beings. So that's that paragraph. So again, Yasutani Roshi says, if you're enlightened, it's no good. If you're not enlightened, it's even worse. And if you don't break out in a cold sweat over this, nothing will be accomplished. And let's see what Nishihari Bokusan on this paragraph before we go on to the next one. If you hold on to old views of the self, the Dharma can't get in. If you surrender and throw your entire body into the Buddha's house, today's practice of walking, abiding, sitting, and lying down is done from the side of Buddha. It's like forgetting the self. And only when we practice each moment of time as the entire time and each Dharma as the entire Dharma do we know the intimacy of the self and myriad Dharmas, the way that the myriad Dharmas and the self are intimately interwoven. At that time, each thing becomes your Dharma. In other words, give rise to the mind of no abode. I just happened to quote that story from the Six Ancestors' realization on Wednesday, and so it appears again here. To abide at ease in the place of no abode is to forget the self. In this way, to forget the self is to thoroughly become myriad dharmas. At this time, the self is the entire self standing at one without conditions, or without being related to anything else. It is everything. And then referring to this last section about no traces, similar, he says, when you're enlightened, you should completely forget about enlightenment. This is great practice. This is called letting go, but this is very hard practice. All the distinguished teachers abide in glory and enjoy bringing up the past. Compared to this, Ikkyu was great. He said, I don't remember making a mistake called enlightenment. I thought that was nice. This is good. He doesn't look outstanding or distinguished, and he doesn't have the stink of enlightenment. Needless to say, he doesn't act violently like swinging a fist or hitting with a stick or giving a shout. Here is the chew dropping off. So that was something that I can't remember the question last week, but like something like, well, how do you know, or you know, what's the criteria for this? And I thought this was a nice way to just say, you know, they're like, don't remember making this mistake, but they're like, live this very harmless and kind life. You know, it manifests in this way that maybe isn't even really noticed, but how it plays out in the world seems to be the key thing. Because harming others comes from carrying the self forward and verifying them as wrong. Verifying the myriad things as wrong, bad, and worthy of me harming them. Instead, you let the absence of a trace of enlightenment emerge long, long, long. You must travel through the three realms magnificently with this absence of a trace of enlightenment through three countless kalpas and 100 more. This is it. So then he's talking about all these like ranks and stages of bodhisattva practice. He's saying is the long, long, long emerging of the absence of trace of enlightenment. So like without this trace, then there's, you know, what could be described in the sutras as going through these stages of realization. But there's no, for the person going through them, they might not even notice that they're going through them. But then they can be written about in the sutras. And we can talk about them, and it looks like lots of traces being written about. Bodhisattvas of great power appearing in various forms, responding to circumstances, is the bare magnificence of the absence of any trace of enlightenment. Body and mind dropping off is the beginning of practice. Adding practice verification to this body mind dropping off is indeed the Genjo Koan of the Buddha ancestors' practice verification. So, really, I would say that dropping off body and mind, practice and verification, and Genjo Koan are all synonyms, really. Many of the things that Dogen says are like the ultimate point are all synonyms. Genjo Koan, actualizing the fundamental point, is practice and actualization. And that is body and mind dropping off. But here he kind of like sets them up with a little different emphasis, saying first there's dropping off body and mind, and then there's adding practice and verification to the body and mind dropping off. And that's the Genjo Koan. So I think he's kind of just playing with these phrases, but maybe the point being made is that after this dropping off, there's practice, there's coming forth, there's actually doing something. There's living this life as practice. So now we get into the next section. And when you first see Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs, but Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. And so the point mainly here is about seeking the truth somewhere else, outside ourselves. And I think this is true. When we first hear about practice and Buddha Dharma, we, if we read a sutra or something or hear this kind of thing, we think it's, you know, this sounds great, but it's like so far away from my experience. I have to practice a lot to reach and understand such a realm. And Dogen's saying, right from the start, Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately the original person that you are. There's nothing lacking from the beginning. And so we might think, then, just don't seek outside oneself. That does seem to be the instruction, but it's tricky, and most of the commentaries bring this up as like, well, this is a dangerous point, because if you can take this in a kind of surface way and say, therefore, we don't really need to practice because we're immediately our original self, and so seeking anything is off track. And Dogen, again and again, does make the point that seeking is delusion. Yes?
Does he mean there, when you first begin practice, sort of the bodhicitta experience, or totally the naively, we are actualizing the fundamental point. Naively, we are already dropping off.
Yeah, I think he means that really completely. That Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You're asking, is it when the first seeking of Dharma at that moment it's transmitted, as opposed to
You've never heard of Buddha.
I take it as you've never even heard of Buddha. But that's interesting that you could take it either way. Is that at the first moment of I hear about this practice and I want to practice, it's like Suzuki Roshi has that phrase, it's wisdom which is seeking wisdom. It's like when we first are attracted to practice, you know, we don't even know why often, but I think it's some... When I hear that Suzuki Roshi phrase, I think of like it's like our Buddha nature is like something is woken up by like some words that we maybe don't even really understand, but there's something true about this, and it sends, you know, a shiver up my body to hear it, and I don't know what to do about this, but like the story of Huai Nung in the marketplace, you know, he had never heard about Buddhism, and he just heard this phrase from the Diamond Sutra, and he's like, maybe didn't even completely get the words, but like, oh wow, and now I want to practice. Then his way-seeking mind arose, and he went to find the fifth ancestor. So, what the commentaries seem to say, at least some of them seem to say that it's, you know, right from the start, immediately, nothing's lacking. But the realization is that to really truly realize that nothing's been lacking from the start, and like without the slightest doubt, is the completion of the path. But nothing's ever been lacking. But we can say that and hear that over and over. But you know, there's either great doubt about that, or at least a little doubt sometimes. When we're really like in a big mess, then we think, okay, well, there was nothing lacking yesterday, but now this is. I'm not willing to say that this is like the original manifestation of complete perfection. But then this point about seeking, Nishiari Bokusan says we should be aware of the tendency of beginners to say, it's no good to seek for Dharma, so I will not pursue it. You know, we hear this thing and then the energy drops out of practice maybe when we hear these ultimate teachings. And I think this is a huge topic that's in a tradition like Soto Zen in particular, where these non-dual traditions, where they're over and over again the teachings that, you know, personally I enjoy the most, and I think maybe most people are drawn to, is over and over again we're saying you really are okay from the start, like completely okay. Mm-hmm. We love that, right? That's what draws us to it. Mm-hmm. And yet we can hear it in a way that's like, we can use that in a way when we're not fully, there's still a little doubt, but there's enough of the doubt is gone that we can say, well, then I don't really need to like exert this life completely to completely like get to the bottom of this, you know. It's like, and then there's all different gradations. I'll exert this life to some extent to get to like this extent, and then it works pretty well. but then we look at these ancestors, and they all had these teachings before they practiced this really, you know, laying their life on the line for practice often. They all heard this beforehand, which is one of these big contradictions. That was Dogen's big koan, right? It's like, I've heard this is teaching that we're already perfect from the start, so why do we have to like exert our practice so fully like this? It doesn't make sense. And like while he was working on that, he was exerting his practice really fully, and then it was resolved. So it's hard to talk about this dichotomy, I think. But here's, you know, his take to just encourage people to not fall into complacency. And he says, don't make this mistake of just saying, I don't need to pursue it because I shouldn't seek. Dogen Zenji says this from the viewpoint of the original suchness of Dharma. It's not possible to perfectly fit with Dharma at the beginning of our practice, so not seeking for Dharma is out of the question. Now we could say this is kind of maybe skillful means, because of course we do perfectly fit with it, but he's saying it's not possible to perfectly fit with this reality, you know, understanding it, we could say. So you must endeavor with urgency, even sacrificing everything. By doing so, you come to understand that non-attainment is the true face of Dharma. It's kind of like the joke of practice in a way. In the end, what you understand is that there's nothing to attain, but to fully understand it, we have to completely exhaust any possibility, make full effort to, not exactly to attain, but to get to the bottom of the matter. If your doubt about this is big, then the enlightenment is big. Only when you get to the extreme of seeking mind do you arrive at no seeking. And Suzuki Roshi, I think, also has this similar phrase in a chapter on effort. So here he says, when you get to the extreme of seeking mind, then you arrive at no seeking. And I think Suzuki Roshi says, you must make great, complete effort right up to the moment of no effort. And it's almost like you don't create the moment of no effort, but you like make the total effort, and then like effort drops away on its own. But that's how I would see this here too. Therefore, you must start out with a great determination to practice thoroughly, study with the teacher, study the scriptures, study the 3,000 rules for monks, and the 80,000 detailed activities. So just like cover this whole Dharma. And then the part about Dharma's already correctly transmitted. You're immediately your original self. Only when you forget yourself and forget Buddha Dharma is Dharma correctly transmitted to you. When Dogen said to Ru Jing, Master, please do not give your seal of approval so easily, which is part of the story. After this dropping off body and mind, he went to Ru Jing and said, offered incense and said, body and mind's dropped off. And do you know the story? And Rujing, his teacher, said, dropped off body and mind. Which, interestingly, then Dogen said, don't approve me so easily. Or don't verify me so easily. Even though he just said the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a very dynamic conversation between them, I think, too, of like, and then it goes on about something like, I'm not verifying you too easily. And then, you know, the dropping off has dropped off. And then it goes on. But when Dogen says this, he says, this was indeed body and mind dropped off. Don't approve me so easily is the body and mind dropped off. The time of body and mind dropped off is the place of no seeking. It's as plain as a blank wall. You've been busily running around like a thirsty person looking for water. But now when you become your original person, then what will you think? You understand that even before taking one step, there was already the original face and eye and the complete Buddha Dharma abiding where bodhicitta first arose. This cannot be understood without 20 or 30 years of endeavor in the face of extreme hardship. So, this is true. Do we need 20 or 30 years of extreme hardship? Ultimately, of course not. But then, how do we, complete a life's work? As the Buddha said right at the end of that first sutra, which is my realization is unshakable. Now there's no more for becoming, no more further becoming. So what's the unshakability? When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So this metaphor of the boat and the shore, interesting metaphor. And they say, well, it's a metaphor or simile, so it can't be taken completely. They're all limited in a way. But there is that phenomena of thinking that we're permanent and the world is going on around us. And practice intimately, return to where you are, is, as Rob said, just being present. And we could also say turning the light around and shining the light of awareness back to where we are, meaning like right here, this experience, then it will be clear that nothing at all has this unchanging self. Now there's a section on firewood and ash, which is a metaphor for life and death. So this birth and death, life and death issue, which was brought up right in the first paragraph, right, that as all things are Buddha Dharma, there's birth and death, and as the myriad things are without an abiding self, there's no birth and death. So now this issue is going to be brought up again more thoroughly.